Hey guys and gals, hope you're staying healthy and resilient out there. I was very busy in the last few weeks preparing with Mark Felstead, weloveourheart.com. We did an online virtual conference with some superb doctors, professors, and medicine speakers and Q&A sessions. Glad to say it was stressful, but it went down really well last Saturday. So more on that later, but weloveourheart.com, you can get the details. And just a note of huge appreciation to my patrons who keep the train on the track as I continue to analyze and present on the world's challenges. And a note that I've just done a new video on revisiting my 2020 data-centric videos on the viral challenge. And because of current challenges, if you go down below, you'll see the link to my Odyssey channel. So the latest videos are down there. And I think you find them really interesting because I'm revisiting what we were saying way back in 2020 and what we were predicting. And it's fascinating for me as I went back through slide by slide and look at what actually happened. So I think you'll really find that a useful resource. But again, on my Odyssey and other platforms, link below. So with that, let's get on to our interview today, podcast interview with Dr. Stephen Hussey, and a very, very interesting conversation on the evolutionary background of the heart. Hey guys, another fascinating podcast today, and we're going to be talking about the heart again. As you know, we love the heart on this channel. And today I've got Dr. Stephen Hussey, and we talked quite some time back, maybe a couple of years ago, and he's got a new book out, Understanding the Heart, which goes into the evolutionary side of heart disease. So great to see you again, Stephen.
Good to see you. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. Pleasure. And it's been some time, hasn't it? I remember. Oh, it's a while back, isn't it?
Yeah, maybe 2 years or more.
And I think back then we were probably talking heart disease also and glycocalyx and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, same kind of stuff. It's always relevant.
Absolutely, yeah. And people out there, they love to hear about the glycocalyx and the different layers and all the technology. And I think you're bringing in some new material as well on further layers that we touched on before, but you're in your book going to explain them much more fully.
Yeah, definitely. So yeah, I look into there's one chapter in my book where I talk about atherosclerosis, and there's a layer that is not commonly talked about, a layer of the endothelia, or not of the endothelia, but a layer on top of the endothelia that is not commonly talked about. And it's kind of recently discovered because you have the endothelia and the various layers of that, and you have the glycocalyx, but there's also this kind of outer barrier that's made up of water in a specific state. And so it turns out that water is this very unique liquid in that it can hold energy. And this is evidence, this is all work coming out of the lab of Dr. Gerald Pollack at University of Washington, and then others before him, like Gilbert Ling and Albert St. George. And so this ability of water to hold energy actually allows it to structure itself in a different way that's not solid, liquid, or gas. But it only structures itself when it holds energy and it's next to a hydrophilic surface. And it turns out the lining of arteries are very hydrophilic. And so since the water is about half blood, if the body and the water in the body holds energy, enough energy, then it actually structures itself into this, what's known as, or what's being called fourth phase water, or it's called structured water or exclusion zone water. There's many different names for it. And what happens is that actually, like if you look at a water molecule, there's an oxygen and two hydrogens, and one of the hydrogens gets cleaved off. And all the other oxygen and hydrogen pairs that are left kind of team up, and they form like this lattice-like structure of hexagonal rings. And they kind of form like a planar structure, and they stack up on each other. And it makes kind of like this, it's kind of like gel. Think of like jello. So it's like this four state. It's not solid, not liquid. It's kind of in between. It's kind of this gel state. And they've actually proven that this actually does happen in chick embryos, in their lab, in the arteries of chick embryos. And so this structured water that forms there does two things. One, it actually, they call it exclusion zone water because it excludes anything that's not it. So only very small hydrated ions can move through it, like nitric oxide being one of them. And so anything that's not it excludes it. So that means like cholesterol, red blood cells, all kinds of things like endotoxins, bacteria. They're way too big to even penetrate this layer as long as the layer is intact. And that's the key, is making sure the layer is intact. And then the other thing it does is it actually, the way that it creates this energy gradient, because the oxygen is just a bigger molecule. So you cleave off a hydrogen and now that becomes a very negative space. And so then the other hydrogens that are in the middle of the lumen of the artery now are a very positive space, and that creates an energy gradient that actually creates blood flow. It actually, it's kind of acts like kind of like a battery. And they've done these experiments where they take, you know, water that's been energized. They put a hydrophilic tube in it, and the water just starts to flow through the tube with no pumping action, no motor or anything like that. So it's very, very fascinating in respects to heart disease, because it's this outer layer that's like this initial protective layer, or it can be, as long as we're doing things to keep this water intact, which is pretty fascinating. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's amazing stuff. And I mentioned before we went on here that, yeah, I've come across the fourth phase of water and the Pollock stuff, but I never really delved in. Though I do recall us chatting, and from the many papers I got in Glycocalyx, I remember one really good one, and it showed the exclusion zone. So you can see the little hairs of the glycocalyx, or hair-like kind of structures. And then beyond that, there's this boundary layer. And I think they might have used the word exclusion zone. And you can even see the red blood cells kind of slightly curved in small capillaries. And depicted in the drawing, it showed them bending and just staying clear of the hairs because it's running along this boundary layer. So I didn't go any deeper, but fascinating stuff.
Yeah, and I remember at Low Carb Houston 2018, I think it was, way back there. I was there and you spoke and you mentioned you had some images from a study that you mentioned that, and you could see the red blood cell that was sitting on top of the layer. But there was one thing inaccurate about that picture, was that they had little cholesterol molecules, little LDLs kind of coming through the exclusion zone, which is not possible because of how the exclusion zone works. Like it's so small that there's no way. Cholesterol is way too big. Even HDL is way too big to get through that layer as long as it's intact. Now, when it becomes damaged, or we do things to our body that damage it, then yes, those things can get through. But it's really fascinating to think about that, because it tells, like, I don't know if you ever looked at the research on infrared sauna or steam sauna in general and heart disease. And it's pretty phenomenal how good it is for heart disease patients, especially people with atherosclerosis and people with heart failure. But the reason being is that in Dr. Pollock's lab, they found that the number one energy absorbed by water is radiant light from infrared light, particularly the 3000 nanometer wavelength. So if we want to energize the water in our bodies, like the water in our blood, to get it to structure itself and help protect the lining of the artery, infrared light is the best way to do it. And so then you look at the research on infrared sauna and heart health, and it's just phenomenal. It's like, well, that makes sense, that's what we're doing.
And that, as you say, that's the actual mechanism underlying it. But light is so amazing. In any case, I mostly focused on UV. So we've got UVA from the sun or from lamps, and it's been demonstrated to collapse blood pressure. The UVA, of course, is part of creating the nitric oxide, which is one mechanism. Then we have UVB, of course, to create vitamin D, which contributes to general health and heart health and so many other ways. And then we've got, as you say, the infrared spectrum, which provides energy, helping with flow and helping with the general state of the system. So it's just amazing, isn't it? The business, the industry of sunscreen has hyped the negative effects of sun when it's overwhelmingly positive, without burning, of course. You don't want to burn your skin. No evolutionary humans went out and burnt their skin. They're not idiots. But short of burning, it's all goodness, right?
Yeah, definitely. And the sunscreen industry is terrible, in my opinion, at least the toxic forms of it, because it's not only preventing you from getting those various forms of energy to your body to, you know, like you said, produce the nitric oxide and the vitamin D and then energize the water so we can create this barrier that helps with flow and protects the artery and everything. But it's also putting toxins into your body that are known to directly damage like this barrier. Because if you think about it, so this is a very electronegative space because of the way that it forms and it cleaves off the hydrogen and the oxygen, such a bigger molecule. And so it has these electrons to donate. And so if we've got free radicals in the system from whatever, whether it's endotoxins or damaged LDL or various other toxins, like if we've got things in there that are looking for electrons to steal, they're going to steal it from this barrier. They're going to steal it from the fourth phase water and break it down. And so then that gets broken down. Then the glycocalyx gets damaged. Then the endothelia gets damaged. And then, you know, we form this atherosclerosis. And then in combination with that, if we're insulin resistant, then the body can't repair those cells either. And that's when we get this development of atherosclerosis. So it all starts with this oxidative stress, free radical overload that damages all these different layers. And then the underlying, you know, poor metabolic health that doesn't allow it to repair itself is what develops into atherosclerosis. And you know, you've spoke out about interesting theories about inside out and how that forms, but it all starts with the damage to the endothelia and this fourth phase water layer.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting you mentioned that, Stephen, but the inside out and outside in, I was being a little bit corporate political clever there. So we can have the situation where LDL bombards from the inside of the lumen into the endothelium and fills up your artery wall, right? That's the cholesterol statin guys, or Dayspring and Atea, etc. That's an extreme position. And as Dr. Malcolm Kendrick recently in his book, The Clock Thickens, utterly destroys that, as so many of us have done over the years. But then the other extreme position is to say LDL has zero, zilch, nothing, never goes in the wall, etc. And that's another extreme. And I kind of said, okay, well, let's take their viewpoint, you know, that the LDL kind of gets in, and let's make a case, well, okay, even if it gets in, it doesn't get in the way you say at all. And what you're saying is completely wrong. Even if you allow that it does somehow get in and you accept that premise. And that was the whole inside out, outside in. But I agree with you. My question really was, is even the entry, even from the outside in, really the driver of atherosclerosis?
Right. And I would say that it's not, because, well, it's interesting too, like what people have found inside, you know, the fibrotic tissue that is atherosclerosis. They found like oxalates, they found bacteria, they found all kinds of stuff. So it's just like, it kind of makes sense that, like, when you talk about like outside in, you know, when it's fenestrated, when they're making new arterioles in there, like it makes sense that things are just leaking in, whether it's LDL or whatever else is in the blood, they just end up into the lining of the artery, because that's what we see when we kind of dissect it out and see what's in it. So it's interesting.
Yeah. And as Malcolm goes through from the name, The Clot Thickens, that essentially endothelial glycocalyx, injury to the inner wall, injury to the artery, followed by a clotting process, followed by new endothelial cells from progenitor cells that billions are flowing around all the time, kind of cover up, because the body can't just break up the clot in the artery wall because it could go down and block something. So it kind of papers over it with new endothelial cells, and then another insult comes. And essentially then the plaque is a series of clots over time growing into a really big clot, as you say, full of all kinds of crap. And with, as he suggests, the cholesterol that's in there, primarily from the red blood cells, which form part of the clot to repair the artery.
Yeah, it's interesting. And one question that I've come across and I don't have an answer to is that, you know, so I talk about this fourth phase water, exclusion zone water, that does form itself on the glycocalyx and the endothelial lining because it's hydrophilic. And that's what it needs. It needs energy and hydrophilic surface. And so then I've asked myself, well, what happens when we get this fibrotic cap over lining of the artery somewhere? Is that hydrophilic or is it not? And if it's not, is that why we see people with heavy atherosclerosis developing heart failure? Because we're not getting that flow mechanism because the fourth phase water is not able to form on that. I don't know the answer to that, but I would suspect that since fat is very hydrophobic, that it may interfere with that. But I don't know. And I've asked people in Pollock's lab if they're looking into it, and they say they are, but it's just very early stages of looking into it. But that would be a fascinating question to get answered.
Yeah, and a necrotic kind of messy plaque, it's a hot mess. I'm sure it's disrupting so many systems. And at the same time, the body is trying to paper over it, managing it. But as you say, if you're insulin resistant, you know, your type 2 diabetic physiology, or you've got autoimmune disease of various types, or any of these problems, the body's not going to be able to heal properly. And at the end of the day, serious atherosclerosis that causes you to have a heart attack or whatever, it's that the repair never kept up with the damage. I guess even a very healthy person, if you really look close, will have small areas of damage, especially in the kind of junction points of the arterial tree where there's a lot of stress, and you do get some natural damage occasionally. But then if the body can simply repair it and move on, you're still okay. But if your repair process is kind of crap and you're driving a high rate of micro damage, then, you know, things run away on you. That day, heart attacks, etc.
Yeah, after everything I've looked at, I've come to kind of realize that I think that, you know, small amounts of atherosclerosis are just kind of normal wear and tear, but the body's always supposed to be able to repair it. It's very good at that if we don't break our metabolism and break our insulin sensitivity. If we do that, then we're headed down a bad road. And unfortunately, the things that break insulin sensitivity are also the things that lead to increased oxidative stress and things that drive the damage in the first place. So we're really setting ourselves up for, poor outcome there.
Yeah, that's essentially a pylon. And once the pylon starts, you know, unless you do something dramatic, like switch to low carb, real foods and get magnesium, potassium and get UV and get infrared and get all the stuff. It is, in fairness, the one thing I'll hand to the cholesterol nonsense theorists is they keep saying it's multifactorial. And it is. But the problem, the industry often uses multifactorial to kind of make things seem hopeless, except for the drug. You know, it's multifactorial. There's too many factors. There's 300 causes of heart disease. Yeah, but if you do Pareto principle and you rack and stack up to the top 10 that cause 90% of the problem, you can address them beautifully. You know, I was thinking about natural damage or normal damage is an example from Dr. Scott Murray, a cardiologist pal of mine, published papers on calcification dynamics and everything. He's done intravenous ultrasound. So he's a research cardio, super smart. And he had a case of a guy in his 50s who had a heart attack while exercising, I think it was. Maybe he was late 40s. He was reasonably okay, healthy, but hypertriglyceridemia, you know, a little bit modern male in his 40s, but not too bad. So he had the heart attack and they went in and they found out there was one major area of plaque that had kind of slightly ruptured, bit of a clot. And it was at a junction in his arterial tree that was quite prone, it looked like. So it was kind of a weakness of birth, perhaps, because the rest of his arterial tree was looking pretty great. So it was the one turbulent point where he had a weakness. And amazingly, or luckily, he had a twin brother, a genetic twin. And the twin brother was, I think, in Germany. But he was coming over to the UK and they asked him, you know, would you do an actual angiogram for research and maybe help your brother and maybe find out if you have a problem? And he said, okay. So he went in and they went down to the same spot. Guess what? He had a plaque in the same spot.
Oh, wow.
So I think their lifestyle certainly contributed. I'm sure if both those guys were living 10,000 years ago in Northern Europe, ranging across the land and hunting, nothing really would have happened those points. But they're not, you know, they're a little overweight, you know, a little insulin resistant. But either way, yeah, it just shows you there's a whole layer of kind of the physical makeup of your arteries that also contributes to those weak spots. But in fairness, even at the weak spots or in not so weak spots, it'll always be the damage to the internal layers that leads to the problem.
Yeah. And like those weak spots, we say, are just like those turbulent spots. Like when I came across this evidence that, you know, that the heart is not the only thing moving some blood, that the arteries have their own kind of mechanism by this fourth phase water mechanism of moving blood. And I think about how, you know, people aren't exposed to the right light. You know, people are sitting under like fluorescent light and things like that. And they're not outside as much. And especially in the winter and how heart attacks are more common in the winter. It makes sense like that the blood is not flowing like it's supposed to. And that can create these spots, these little pools of spots where there's turbulent flow. And so if you have high oxidative stress, then those free radicals are just kind of pooling in this one spot where it's not flowing as well. And you get this stagnant, kind of hypoxic blood that causes damage in an area. And those tend to be where we see, you know, higher amounts of atherosclerosis and clots that form if they break, you know, if those atherosclerosis breaks off. So it makes sense. So like, that's another reason why I think that like infrared sauna therapy and just being out in the sun and getting the right types of light has been shown to, you know, improve outcomes with all types of heart disease.
Yeah, I'd say for myriad, but quite a few factors, and that's one of them. And you know, it reminds me as well, Stephen, of earthing. And now I stayed away from earthing naturally because you're going to get attacked as anything from a quack to a conspiracy theorist to talk about earthing. And earthing, for people who aren't aware, is the idea that it's not healthy to be separated from the earth too much, to be insulated by your shoes and your beds that we sleep on. And people kind of connect themselves through a bit of a strap to ground. And I thought, well, look, it sounds like utter woo, but I did dig into it because one or two pretty smart guys were giving it credence. And I did found a couple of papers, very little now, because the industry has no interest in something that cannot be patented and basically anyone can do it themselves, right? That's the kind of thing you censor. You don't encourage it. So so basically there was one paper and they scanned the potential, the charge of people when they were actually earthed feet to ground and when they were not. And they called it the zeta potential, I think. But you could see this enormous difference in charge. Now, whatever about the physiological benefit of that is a separate question. But I was interested to see there is a huge difference in charge in the human body. And I said, so that's a fact. That's something that really is different in the body. And there was one other paper, I think, that showed a direct effect on blood pressure by having fully earthed versus not, which I suppose would speak to the ease of flow and to the charge-based mechanisms you're talking about. But there's very little out there officially in the published literature, unsurprisingly. But imagine they went after that and really explored it, like they explored drugs. I mean, who knows what stuff you'd find.
Yeah, well, I mean, the Earth gives off this electromagnetic energy, and it's compatible with our electromagnetic energy, whereas like 5G and things and Wi-Fi are not so compatible with our electromagnetic energy that we give off. And I talk about that in the book because, you know, like we talk about like all the biochemistry, and we know a lot about that because of the pharmaceutical industry and all the research they do. We know a lot about this biochemistry and how we're biochemical beings, but we're also very, I say, physical beings, very physics. We have a physics side to us. And it makes sense too. Like if you think about like earthing or grounding, like, you know, for the millions of years that we were evolving as humans, we were, you know, barefoot or at least very close to the earth. So why wouldn't we evolve a mechanism to utilize that, you know, or to keep us healthy if that's what we were doing for millions of years? And it's only recently that that we've kind of isolated ourselves from that and closed that off. So it makes sense, you know. But yeah, there are a few papers. I discussed a few of them in the book about grounding, and it's just one, you know, small strategy people can use. There are many others. But yeah, it's very fascinating that we have this physics side to us, and how that, you know, affects not just our cardiovascular system, but our whole body.
Yeah. And that's it, physics. And that's the funny thing. When people think things sound like woo, they never really analyze themselves. Well, why do I think it sounds like that? And often the reason is simply no one brought it up before, and it doesn't sound scientific in a sense. But when you dig into some of these things, now there's a lot of woo out there, don't get me wrong, but that was a good example, the grounding, that has demonstrated physical, real world, physiological shifts and changes that would or must be relevant at some level. But yeah, I think, and I don't mean to harp on about it, the industry also, whether the food, the pharma or what, or even academia in their own way, they have an automatic censuring or shutting down a conversation of many topics, you know, that lead away from pharmaceuticals, that lead away from procedures, that lead away from the business, that head anywhere towards natural, evolutionary. You know, the recent attack on meat, and I know this is not connected, but I'm just looking in horror. The last couple of years, the attack on real evolutionary human foods, meats, is gathering pace, and it makes zero sense.
Yeah, and that's something I address early in the book, you know, about how it makes no sense that a food we've been eating for you know, literally since we were became human, you know, 300,000 years ago, and even before that, what drove or part of what drove that evolution to becoming modern humans today is a food that's being demonized today. But yeah, it's all industry, because I even think that, you know, we talk about grounding and everything, and how that's, there's not much funding for doing research on that because it's not profitable, you know, and the people who are going to invest in that research want there to be profits from it. The same with infrared sauna. Like if you look at the research on infrared sauna and even just finished sauna, that's not infrared, just like warming your body up, and how phenomenal it is for heart health and people with heart disease. It's just boggles my mind that there's not an infrared sauna or not some sort of therapy like that in every cardiac rehab center everywhere, but it's just not profitable, or not as profitable as they would like it to be. So of course there's not going to be. And most of the research on infrared sauna, it's from Japan. It's not even from the States, you know, and a little bit from Germany and stuff, but yeah, if it's not going to benefit, someone, then they're not going to invest in the research to do it. So then you think people who are so, you know, evidence-based, and I'd like to be evidence-based, but if you're going into the evidence and there's nothing there, it doesn't mean that it's not a real thing. It just means that no one has wanted to fund that research. And maybe we should look for ways of funding it. Or you think you're going to get an accurate depiction of what the research says about something, but there just may have not been enough funding to get both sides of things, you know?
Yeah, no, agreed, Stephen. The problem there is you're literally talking about philanthropy to fund it, because even good guys who'd like to find out the answers and make it available, putting in money these days into anything is really hard. It's like everyone kind of needs some return, and there's really no return there, because the technology, if it turned out to prove it to be highly important, literally anyone, any company, it can't be patented, and anyone can go and just make them up, infrared stuff. I actually have not an infrared sauna. I've never looked into that, though I've heard quite a bit. I must look into it more, or I've got to read your book. But I do have a set of 12 160 watt reptile lamps, and I also have a UV tanning panel. Now, the reptile lamps you can get for around $35 each, so you can make a low cost 2 kilowatt reptile solarium. And of course, it's got the UVA, UVB, and it's also got red spectrum. I'm not sure about infrared, but I will say that when you have a tanning panel on one side that's UV A and B biased, it's kind of not so warm or pleasant. It's just blue light. You got your glasses on. But on the other side, I have my 2 kilowatts array of reptile lamps. Now, they are gorgeous. So what I have is these two machines are in a little spare room beside the bathroom. So anytime I get a shower, I don't need to go up and undress, use the lights, dress again, leave. You know, there's a bit of hassle there. I come out of the shower, straight into the room, you drop the towel, and you bask for 15 minutes. But the tanning panel is fine, it's great, but the reptile lamps give you this, oh, it's hard to describe. I suppose it's like an infrared lamp sauna. You're just, the heat, it's gorgeous.
Well, I mean, people like, you know, I've been like, you know, you're inside or something, and you go out like on a decently warm day, and you get the sun hits you. Like, ugh, it feels amazing, right? And there's a reason for that. Your body loves that, and it's gaining from it. Because, you know, I talk about infrared a lot, but in reality, there's so many different wavelengths of light that your body will absorb energy from. It's just that in Pollock's lab, they found that infrared was the most absorbed. But UVA, UVB, all those types of things, they'll energize your body too, energize the water in your body as well. It's just that one was the most absorbed.
Yeah, and the point on the sun, there's no question. I remember even back memories when I was young, how great you'd feel, how much better you'd sleep after you'd had a decent amount of sun, maybe up to the point of pinking. And if you got just a little too much, you're still not burned, but you're quite pink, you know. I noticed when I was young that the veins on my head would stand out, the arteries, the veins. They're almost thumping. And I thought, what's that? And I think in the end, that was the UVA effect of nitric oxide, along with some other effects, maybe a little bit of local inflammation as well, causing more blood flow. But your arteries are opening up to the point of being visible on your skull. And that's just one thing. But people know when they're on a sun holiday, part of it is they relax, of course, as well, a bit more than the work week. But the sheer exposure to sun just makes you feel better. And my lamps essentially achieved the same thing in the Irish winter.
Exactly. Yeah, in Ireland, you know, not as much sunlight there. So it's those are good tools to have at your disposal.
Perfect stuff. So I know you wanted to keep a kind of a tight one today, Stephen. So any other key things, particularly from the book, that you'd kind of highlight, and then we'll get into the details of when and where it's available.
Yeah. So in the book, I kind of go through like this, this evolutionarily, I guess, perspective of heart disease and everything from like, you know, the first multicellular organisms all the way through human evolution and kind of try and understand the why we have these imbalances today that are causing heart disease. But I go into topics like how the heart is not the main mover of blood and how I think there's these other mechanisms that are driving it and the body of research that suggests that. And I go into, you know, the fourth phase water underlying the arteries and how I think that plays into atherosclerosis and as well as, heart attacks that can happen with no blockage whatsoever, because there are so many cases where that happens. People have heart attacks, they have tissue death, and there's no blockage, or they go in and they don't find anything. And so I go into the mechanisms of that and how I think that can happen based on imbalance in the autonomic nervous system. And I go into why I believe heart cancer is, you know, the rarest form of cancer. It's definitely possible, but it's very, very rare. And so I go into the mechanisms, I think that, and then I go into obviously diet and various other things that people can do, like practical information, testing. I think that it's important and those kinds of things. But these ideas that I think hopefully broaden the conversation about heart disease and give us a better, quote unquote, understanding of the heart.
Excellent. And you know what? That resonates. I'm working with Mark Felstead in Germany with We Love Our Heart, a kind of a new organization we're setting up, a kind of club to avoid heart attacks or to recover faster. And one thing that does come up regularly, and I always stress, the non-atherosclerosis per se, heart attacks. And like dissection is one thing, you know, where the artery has a bit of a genetic or what other weakness. So someone has a heart incident, but it's not actually atherosclerosis. But people, I know there's a lot of people out there who would find that fascinating, is that whole topic which you go into on the non-classic heart attacks and the ones where the muscle spasms or fails essentially, but it's not due to the classic atherosclerosis. That's one that a lot of people have interest in, and quite a few people are turning up who had an event, it was verified. What else did you mention there as well, outside of that topic, just before that?
Before?
It resonated.
I mentioned the heart cancer being rare, and then I mentioned the fourth phase water. Oh, yeah, and the heart not being the main mover of the blood.
That was the one, the heart. And this is one that many people have written to me over the years, and I'll admit I haven't got into it yet, but have brought up that topic. Now, I'm glad you said main mover, because it's hard to get away from the heart with its valve system and the incredible technology, really, that for a whole lifetime of 100 years, for most people, or 80 years, whatever, that muscle will keep, in essence, pumping through its valve system the whole time, for a whole lifetime. It's almost hard to believe. But are you... when they talk about the flow, and you did go through, you know, that the flow is assisted or enabled by the water phase, by the charging, and this is established inside, well, a rail gun, you know, a rail gun just moves the charge along and can send a projectile. But I'm guessing it's in the smaller capillaries, in the periphery, where that mechanism would be more important. Whereas in a big artery coming out near the heart, it's more the pulsing, pumping action of the heart.
Right. Yeah. And so like the heart does do some pumping, but I don't think it's any more than just moving the blood through the heart and through some of the major arteries. Like that's the main thing that it does. But when it gets to the smaller arteries, arterioles and capillaries and things like that, and it's this mechanism of fourth phase water that's propelling the flow, because the fourth phase water also forms around the red blood cells because they're hydrophilic as well. And so that helps them move through as well. Cause you know, the capillary is about, you know, the size of a red blood cell. It's very small and it's just barely getting through there. Right. And so that's, but if people like, I mean, you can look in Dr. Pollack's work, and he's written multiple books on like the fourth phase of water. Also people just ask themselves, like, how does water get from the roots of a tree to the leaves? You know, like there's no pump there. Like these mechanisms are happening in nature. Like this water is this thing, this unique liquid. And so then we have to ask ourselves though, like if we're trying to understand heart failure, where fluid is pooling up in areas where it should be flowing, is it the heart that's broken down, or is it these other mechanisms? Like, and so, if you look at the research on like infrared light and heart failure, it's just phenomenal. Ejection fraction increases, edema goes down, blood pressure goes down. It's phenomenal. It's just like, well, that's because we're actually understanding the mechanism of how blood gets around the body more. We're taking pressure off the heart, and so it gets better, right? It's really, really fascinating.
Yeah, and you know, I'm just thinking there that, I don't know, is he German or Danish or something? The guy who fills, he's a pathologist, but he's become famous. He fills the bodies with wax, and then you're left behind with the wax. And he has sculptures, basically, from real bodies, where he's filled everything with some form of wax. And the fingers, I mean, they're just dense with arterioles. Everywhere is. All these tiny vessels, like you say, not much more than the diameter of a blood vessel or a blood cell. A red blood cell, I think in some of the smallest ones, it kind of bends slightly to get through. These are tiny. So there you're going to have different forces. It's like surface tension and this fourth phase and the charging. That all at that scale, I'm guessing, becomes much more dominant and important. The big pipes near the heart, you're just shoving through big boluses of blood in a pulsating manner. But all around in the tiny ones, if you have something that slightly causes resistance, it'll have a massive backup effect that the heart pumping won't be able to overcome. And if you have something that... Yeah, essentially. And if you have something that slightly, and I'm saying relatively slightly, eases flow in the small capillaries, it'll have a huge effect, because it's acting locally in the tiny vessels. So what you're saying is, it's not just a small, tiny thing, but actually quite a big phenomenon that's occurring in those.
Yeah, and you mentioned like the red blood cells actually bending a little bit sometimes. And so that's the problem with vegetable oils, is because if we're having too much vegetable oils, we're using these unsaturated fats where we should be using, or we're using phytosterol, where we should be using cholesterol to build those blood cells. Because when they use phytosterol, the red blood cells get rigid. They can't bend as well. And so when they get down to these capillaries, if there's nothing propelling them, like there's not enough, you know, energy to the system that's creating this flow, and they're rigid, we're setting ourselves up for stroke, you know, for something that directly damages right there, because they can't bend. So it's all really, really fascinating.
And it sounds like it all kind of synergistically ties up together. So there's no real contradictions here. Like if you take Malcolm Kendrick's book, it doesn't contradict anything I said. Everything you've said and added, those extra elements, doesn't contradict. It's kind of complementary. It's just that the system is very complex. And the best possible thing is to understand all aspects and then live your life with respect for all those aspects and minimize all the negative and maximize all the positive vectors. And that's it, really, unless you have some really weird genetic problem. That should cover nearly everyone who's worried about their health risk.
Yeah, it's about putting your body in the right environment. And that's more than just diet, you know. That's a very, very important one. But it's more to it. And that's kind of my thing, because you talked about, like, you know, the mechanisms by which there's no blockage, there's no, stenosis, and someone still has heart tissue damage. And just briefly, I think it has to do with imbalance in the autonomic nervous system, basically your stress response, and how that's, we get this overwhelming stress response communicated to the heart in certain situations. And that forces a shift in metabolism that leads to more glucose burning than the heart would like, which leads to increased lactic acid. And we end up getting this pressure change situation where it damages heart tissue. And I outline that in the book. And I think it's only a percentage of heart attacks, obviously, but it's a very real thing, I think. And that's my kind of theory as to how that happens.
Right. Well, you know what we'll do? This all resonates, because I have a familiarity there with what you're talking about. I actually got a max pulse meter that does the whole nervous system measurement based on a finger kind of sensor. And I've yet to use it, but It is interesting. The few times I've used it, if you stay up late or you drink too much or anything like that that you know is bad, the results rapidly go off and your heart rate variability goes down. And you can just tell it's a really good measure of whether you're living right or not. And that's, yeah, I haven't even...
Yeah, it's very curious that the best measure of balance in the autonomic nervous system that we have is heart rate variability, which means the heart is intricately connected to our emotional state, our stress response. So it's pretty interesting.
Absolutely. Well, I just before we wrap up, though, and get to the details of the book, just the one on cancer, because you brought this up with me and I remember it resonated. And that was a couple of years ago. Just briefly, the reason why the heart muscle very rarely develops cancer, and it does relate to that metabolism you just mentioned.
Definitely. So you, when you look at the research, the only time the heart actually has a preference for glucose as fuel is when it's been damaged, and in the repair process for a short time it actually prefers glucose, it seems like. But other than that, it always prefers fatty acids and ketones. Like even in the presence of glucose, you put ketones and fatty acids there, it will choose those, it will burn those first, which is interesting because lots of other tissues in the body aren't that way. You have to restrict carbohydrate, restrict glucose in order to get it to burn, you know, ketones and fatty acids. So the heart seems to be a little bit special in that regard. And so, but if that mechanism is there and we know that that cancer is this very glucose loving process, of these cells that are very glucose loving, it makes sense that in a tissue that that is seems predisposed to burning fatty acids and ketones, that cancer is a pretty rare thing. That's one mechanism. And then the other one I think has to do with the physics and the fourth phase water, because fourth phase water is not just something that forms in our arteries. It's also what makes up most of our cells. Because if you like take the tissue of your forearm and you kind of squeeze it, it doesn't feel like a liquid. It doesn't feel like a waterbed. It doesn't feel like ice. It feels like a gel, right? So the water in our cells is also in this fourth phase state, this gel state. And so if that starts to break down, we can get issues with cell replication, and things like that. And so, it's the breakdown of this fourth phase water in the cells that leads to the mistakes that lead to cancer. And it's very interesting that there are studies that show that if you take cancerous DNA and you put it into a healthy cell, that they stay healthy. Right. And if you take damaged cytoplasm and put it into the cell of a cancer cell, in a cell that's cancerous, it turns healthy, right? So it has to do with the cytoplasm more than it has to do with damaged DNA. And to me, that's because there's not enough, you know, structured water there that's allowing for normal processes to happen, for functioning mitochondria, for DNA replication that's not going to create mistakes and things like that. And so the heart is... we were talking about electromagnetic fields. You'd think that the brain would have the highest electromagnetic field of the body, but it's actually the heart. And you can sense it from like, you know, feet and feet away, the heart's electromagnetic field. And this is stuff from the Heart Math Institute. And so in this age where we have all these electromagnetic fields all around us all the time, the heart has its own electromagnetic field that's energizing water there, keeping it structured. So in a sense, it's preventing the breakdown of fourth phase water that leads to the mistakes that happen that lead to cancerous cells. So there's multiple things that I go through in the book that I think are the reason why the heart cancer is one of the rarest forms of cancer. Even if you do get heart cancer, like it's likely to come from metastasis from somewhere else. It's very, very rare that the heart is the primary cancer spot. You know, it's always usually comes from somewhere else.
Right. Excellent. And well, cancer is the other biggie, of course, that most people are really concerned about. Cancer risk next to heart disease, or the pair of them are the two top causes of death. I think the third is actually medical misadventure, or in America anyway, the third cause of death is medical or pharmaceutical related mistakes. Which is kind of crazy too, but that's a topic for another day. Well, the book. So when's it out? Where does one get it, etc.? So I can put links if there's a pre-order down below.
Yeah, it's available for pre-order now. People can find it on Amazon. It's also on the publisher's website, which is Chelsea Green Publishing. It's on Books a Million. It's on Barnes and Noble. So people can find it to those spots if they don't like Amazon for whatever reason. It's coming out April 7th. Like I said, it's available for pre-order now. It's on my website, which is resourceyourhealth.com. People can go out and grab it.
Super, Stephen. So anyone Googling or, well, DuckDuckGoing or whatever, if they don't like Google it, we're living in that age. Dr. Stephen Hussey and the website Resource Your Health, and of course Google in general, and you'll find the book in any case, and I'll put the link down below for pre-order. Thanks a lot, Stephen. Great to talk to you again, and we'll circle back. So till next time.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hey folks, hope you enjoyed that informative session, and I'll put a link in the description box below to his upcoming book. And please remember to give us a thumbs up if you can, and to subscribe, of course, and hit that little notification button too. As always, I really appreciate my Patreon and PayPal supporters, and that's what enables me to do all the work on this platform, on my interviews, editing, on Odyssey platform, where I cover more of the viral material, and indeed everything else I do to help counter some of the corporate and media narrative messages and apply technical expertise to getting to the core of the data and sharing that in an understandable form. So huge appreciation, and it means so much and enables me to stay on my mission. So thank you.